This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker today was Democratic candidate for President of the United States of America, South Bend's Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Pete is in his eighth and final year as mayor of South Bend, Indiana, first elected mayor in 2011 when he was only 29 years old. He was reelected in 2015 with 80% of the vote. Pete is one of 20-some candidates in the Democratic Party who would like to be president of the United States. Actually, Mayor Pete has more years of government experience than President Trump, more years of executive government experience than Vice President Mike Pence, and more military experience than anybody to walk into the Oval Office since President George W.H. Bush. Mayor Pete served as a lieutenant in the U.S. Navy Reserve, took an unpaid seven-month leave during his mayoral term to deploy to Afghanistan. There he earned the Joint Service Commendation Medal. Mayor Pete was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford in England, a graduate of Harvard University. He lives with his husband, Chasten, in the same South Bend neighborhood where he grew up. They have two rescue dogs, Truman and Buddy. Mayor Pete talked about the coming campaign, and he said this campaign must be all about freedom. We're not free, for example, when he addressed the question of reproductive health care if women cannot control their own bodies. Government, he said, enhances our freedom in areas such as water management, waste management. Government can help make people free in ways that they haven't thought. He spent a lot of time talking about security, and he said the Democratic Party in the run-up to the 2020 election should be talking about security. He said the next president must be able to put an end to endless wars. He said that a wall will not give us cybersecurity, but we're going to have to deal with issues to make our elections free and safe. That's what the United States, he said, the bottom line, we are all about. One of the biggest security issues of our time, he said, may very well be climate security. We need to debate seriously, he said, not over weather, but what to do about the effects of weather upon us. Then he talked about the nature of democracy, and he mentioned the rollback of voting rights, a systematic denial of democratic voting rights in the United States. He even said the U.S. is one of the toughest countries to be able to vote in. He says our political landscape needs to change. We have to return to a sense of normalcy that has not been working for many. He concluded by saying, we must restore hope. And running for office, he said, is my way of trying to restore hope.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the kind introduction, for the kind invitation. Thank you, Jay Doherty, for hosting us. I want to acknowledge Frank Paul for cooking up the idea of inviting me here and persuading somebody else to go along with it. So thank you to Frank. And it's a real pleasure to be back in Chicago. When I was a consultant, I lived at Wabash in State. I worked at between Clark and Dearborn and Monroe. I guess I was between Wabash and State on Monroe, so I had about a one-block commute, which I've not been able to replicate, even after moving back to South Bend. And it's great to be back here in what really amounts to spectacular weather by our Midwestern standards. As you know, I'm from South Bend, Indiana. You get on Lakeshore Drive and pick up I-90 about an hour and a half later. You're in our hometown. And there are a great many people here who I think know South Bend very well. There's more than that. Come on. One thing I find myself doing is, as mayor, though, is explaining South Bend a little bit to people who don't know our city, who know perhaps one thing about our community, which is our magnificent University of Notre Dame, which, though it sits technically outside of limits, we're very happy to claim. And yet, because of that, people sometimes assume that we must be a tidy, wealthy, homogenous college town, which is, of course, not our story. Our story is that of a company town that had to figure out for the balance of my lifetime what to do after you lose your company. And in that sense, we are typical of so many communities in the industrial Midwest. that were left wondering what their future was going to look like. The Studebaker Car Company stopped making cars 20 years before I was born. And yet 30 years after that, when I was running for mayor, some people were still talking about it as if we could only get some version of Studebaker back making cars again, our city would be all right. That was how profound the blow of losing some of those jobs had been for us. And what we had to face was that the future wasn't going to look like the past, that the way out of the abandoned factories and the collapsing homes and the population loss and the reduced income wasn't to try to dredge greatness out of some impossible again, but rather to make sure that the future looked different from the past. And that's what we've been able to achieve as a city in the last 10 years. I'm so proud of it. I won't subject you to a full accounting of all of the things we're pleased with, from the parks and recreation upgrades to being able to double down on our boast of having the smartest wastewater system in the world. But what I will do is let you know that we're growing, that our population is growing, that our economy is growing, that we are seeing people lifted out of poverty. We're not there yet. We've got a long way to go in our city. We're celebrating the fact that our per capita personal income has finally gone back above $20,000 in our community. But we're also seeing that our neighborhoods have become cleaner and safer. We're seeing a downtown come back to life. In the same way that downtowns of the biggest cities have come back to life. There were much to do after hours when I made that choice to live in the Loop in 2007. Miller's would give you a spinach pie, and that was about it. Now I come back and I find that even the heart of the commercial business district of this city feels like a neighborhood in some ways. And we've seen that smaller cities can experience that growth too, but only if we properly balance what's happening in our neighborhoods and our lowest income areas with the tremendous potential of the return to our downtowns. What really made it work in South Bend was recognizing that we couldn't just make South Bend great again, that we couldn't rewind. That we had to accept that the future was going to be different than the past. Be honest about it. Be honest that certain things were not coming back, but we were. And then talk about how. That's why I think there's no such thing as an honest politics built around the word again. But I do believe that there can be a very optimistic politics for the industrial Midwest. And it's so important at a time when we were being characterized by the White House and caricatured sometimes by the commentators as a place where the only way to our heart is through nostalgia and through resentment. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we are living through a moment of tectonic change. Change so profound that even in this moment, we may well be underreacting. I think that we have the good and bad fortune of living in a moment that will be as memorable as the beginning of the New Deal or the beginning of the Reagan era. In other words, what will happen in the next 3 or 4 years could set the tone for what will happen in the next 30 or 40. And it's one of the things that motivated me to make the admittedly improbable choice of stepping up as a late 30s Midwestern mayor to run for president of the United States. Not admittedly an obvious career move. And I get that. We were not sure just how many people would take us seriously when I proposed the exploratory committee publicly at a U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting in Washington in January. And yet what we've seen since then is that our message is resonating. The people welcome and embrace the idea of a different kind of leadership. Yes, it is traditional to be marinated in Washington for a few more years before you step up for the presidency. But we're actually living in a moment that's kind of a season for local leadership. It's a season for local leadership because that's where things get done. Consider this. Our national government shut down over a policy disagreement. Can you imagine if that happened to a city government? How long would the mayor be able to physically remain in city limits after the city stopped delivering water, which you need to live? It's unthinkable. Not that our politics aren't ferocious and intense. I am, after all, addressing a Chicago audience. And yet, even in our most ferociously contested moments, you don't talk about a city government shutting down. We just have to get it done. And it's one of the reasons I believe our task is to start to get Washington to look a little more like our best-run cities and towns before the reverse starts to happen. Because I fear that that is exactly the trajectory we might be on. I also know that our part of the country isn't known for producing a lot of Democrats, certainly a lot of progressives. But again, it's precisely for that reason that I want the country to hear voices from Midwestern states like ours, from conservative states like mine. And it's why I think there needs to be a new generation stepping up too. You know, my generation currently is on track to be the first in American history to earn less than our parents if we don't do something to change the trajectory. If you were born when my mother was born, 1945, you had a 90% shot of coming out ahead of your parents. You could more or less assume that that would happen. And for us, it's a coin flip. Some parts of the country, not far from where we're gathered, it's less than 50-50. And so we've got to make sure that that generation is putting forward leaders too. After all, we're also the generation that produced the bulk of the troops after 9/11. We're the generation that, we're not the ones who invented the internet, but we figured out some pretty interesting things to do with it. Many of them beneficial. Some of them not. All the more reason why it's of tremendous importance that the people in the policy world, in charge of figuring out the left and right boundaries for that, have a sense of what it is they're regulating. Not that you have to be from a new generation to do it. Again, it's an older generation that actually invented this stuff. But that we have to pay attention to, and it can't hurt to have some digital natives entering that conversation, not just in the business and philanthropy world, but in the policy world too. So having that different background, that background of a millennial Midwestern mayor, I think has equipped me to offer maybe a different vocabulary for what my party stands for. And I do not seek to shift the center of gravity morally of where my party is. But I do think it would make sense for us to find new ways to talk about it. And it's the main thing I want to discuss with you before we go to questions. There's a lot of hand-wringing over whether Democrats are capable of expressing themselves in bumper sticker language. We are given to long and elaborate policy discussion sometimes, and that's not a demerit. We're policy people, and we ought to be. Policies are how we do good in this world. But sometimes, I fear, we have neglected to vindicate the values that motivate our policies. Something that I think the right, for at least as long as I've been alive, has been highly effective at doing. So part of what I'm trying to do is reintroduce the values that help to explain why we believe what we believe. So that even people who maybe have different values or arrive at different conclusions on policy understand that we came by our views honestly. And it's why I think that this campaign largely must be about freedom. Now, when you think of freedom, when you think of liberty, and you think of whose lips you would expect it to be on in the political world today, you're mostly going to think of people from the right. You're going to think of our conservative friends who are preoccupied with making sure that the government does not restrain our freedom too much. And often that leads to positions on taxes, positions on regulation that suppose that if government is the opposite of freedom, then less government means more freedom. Although it turns out that there are some exceptions to this rule, some of which we're observing in the American South today. Now, I come from Indiana as a Democrat. There are people I love, people I trust, people who support me politically, who view this issue differently than I do. But I must say that I don't think that you are free in this country if your reproductive health can be criminalized by government dictators. This is not an easy choice for anybody to face. And I would be loath to tell anybody facing that situation what the right thing to do is. But that's exactly the point. I'm a government official. I don't view myself as belonging in that conversation. And to see in Alabama that if someone is raped and she seeks an abortion, the doctor who treats her will be penalized with a longer prison term than her rapist makes me question whether the discussion about freedom in this country has gone off the rails. Let me, though, suggest that there is more to freedom on the left or on the right than just getting government out of the way. One of the reasons we invented government as a species is because there are certain freedoms we don't enjoy unless we have policies that tear down the obstacles to us living a life of our choosing. Even the most unglamorous things that mayors work on day in and day out, wastewater and water, I believe are things that enhance our freedom because we have municipal authorities to worry about that sort of thing so we don't have to. But it's also why you're not free, as we learned in Flint, if you have to wonder whether a glass of water that comes out of the tap is going to poison you and your family. It's providing basic services. And it's providing some measure of assurance that the rights that you have in this country and in this life will be secured. It's why I think healthcare is freedom. And I think you're not free if the United States has failed to ensure that you might, for example, be able to start a small business, leaving your old job and starting a new one without fearing that that means you'll lose your health care. I think that you're not free as a consumer if a financial institution is caught ripping you off and you don't have any recourse because you've been forced into arbitration. I certainly think that freedom in this country for people of color has been constrained both by policies and by institutional racism in ways that will not get better just by saying we're going to get government out of the way. If we don't figure out how to lift the veil of mistrust, for example, between communities of color and the law enforcement officers sworn to keep them safe, how can we really say that we're enjoying freedom? And, of course, on a more personal note, I don't think that you can really say that you're free if a county clerk gets to tell you who you ought to marry based on their view of their own religion. So let's talk about freedom in its richest sense and recognize that good government can help make you free just as much as bad government can help make you unfree, and that how big or small it is only the beginning of the conversation. I want to talk about security, because that's another thing that I think has been maybe monopolized by our friends on the right, as though security or the flag or patriotism belong to one political party. I think that's all the more reason people in my party ought to be talking about security. First of all, traditional security issues have not gone away. We see what's going on in the vicinity of Iran right now, to give just one example. We've got to ask ourselves whether this administration is capable of stating what the bar is before you even talk about sending U.S. troops into a conflict. And I say that as somebody who went into a war zone on the orders of a U.S. president. And by the way, was willing to do that, because that's part of the promise you make when you raise your right hand. You don't know who the president's going to be in a few years, let alone what their policies will be. But when I left Afghanistan in 2014, I thought I was turning out the lights. I thought I was one of the last to go. It's 5 years later. We're still there. You could be old enough to enlist and not have been alive on 9/11. And the next president's got to be ready, in the name of U.S. security, to put an end to endless war. Day before yesterday, we did an event with young men and women signing their commitment letters to go into the military. Some go into the academy, some are enlisting right away, some are joining the Guard. And on one sense, it's a very happy occasion. It makes me nostalgic in the way that somebody who has served inevitably and sometimes unbearably gets around young people starting to serve. And I was very proud of them. And their parents were there, and the school principals were there. It was a great event. But then there's this other voice in the back of my head. Actually, not so different than the voice that was in my the back of my head when I saw high school students from the same high schools in our city gathering together in the March for Our Lives to demand better action on gun safety. And the voice in the back of my applaud that. And the voice in the back of my head saying, do not let these kids down. Do not play games with their lives. This is not a game. It is not a show. And we had better make sure that the security decisions made by the president are based not on domestic politics, but on what is the right thing for this nation, and particularly those who have agreed to defend it with their lives. And that's just the traditional stuff we talk about when we think about security. This is the 21st century. That means security means cybersecurity. And one thing that will not help on cybersecurity is putting up a wall from sea to shining sea. Doesn't keep out the bits and the bytes. There's a human factor as well as a technical side to cybersecurity, and we've got to be on top of it. We've got to worry about election security. Our elections are the thing that keep us safe. Our elections, a lot more than a collection of rifles, for example, our elections are the thing that see to it that our government works for us and not the other way around. And our elections, for that very reason, have been attacked. So what are we doing to secure our elections? And what are we doing to look after security in the face of a rising tide of violent white nationalism asserting itself at home and around the world? That's security, too. That's security in a really big way. And we had better be talking about what may well be the biggest security imperative of our time, which is climate security. There's evidence that the Syrian civil war began partly because of forced migration patterns that happened as a result of drought and other issues connected to climate. The same story is increasingly coming into focus when it comes to the rise of Boko Haram in Africa. We probably would not have as many migrants at our borders from Central American countries if it weren't for climate disruption. I myself, in the city of South Bend, had to activate our emergency operations center twice in less than 2 years. One of them was for the 1,000-year flood, and the other was for the 500-year flood. Now, I did not major in math. But I do have an iPhone, and it's got a calculator app on it. And if my math is right, and if it's wrong, somebody here will tell me, I'm sure, but if it's right, the odds of that happening are 125,000 to 1, unless, of course, something has changed in the frequency and severity of extreme weather events, just like they warned us in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, just like they're warning us now. And so I think if we need to start having the debate not over weather but how to adapt, because the people debating whether we ought to do it are going to be left behind. That's a security imperative, adapting and preventing it from getting worse. So let's stop talking about freedom and security like they belong on one side of the aisle, and let's have an adult conversation about what it's going to take to do something about that in our century. And in order for that to happen, it brings me to democracy. We'd like to think of ourselves as a democracy. We like to think that democracy was one of the things that was on the line in some of our nation's finest moments, from its very founding to the way that we played a role in beating back tyranny around the world during the time of World War II. But are we really a democracy? Needless to say, our democracy has always been imperfect. There have been patterns of exclusion in our democracy from the very beginning. But I think it would be fair to say, on balance, most of the time, if you zoom all the way out, that most of us would be able to, not all, but most Americans over the years would be able to say that America became at least a little more democratic by the end of their lives than it was at the beginning. And I'm very concerned that if you're my age, you might not be able to say that. We see a rollback of voting rights, largely motivated by people who seem to have included as a partisan matter that they would be more likely to win if fewer people were likely to vote. And to me, that's an indication that your policies probably need a look. But we've seen this happen systematically with voter ID laws, with making it harder to open up polling places in certain areas, with polls closing too early, with all of the obstacles to voting. We are one of the toughest countries to vote in. In Indiana, when you go to the polling place, did it last week, we had our primary, to start picking my successor in South Bend, there's a big poster in the window that says, stop. And then it tells you about all the terrible things that will happen to you if you're voting with an invalid ID or so forth. Stop. Is that the message we want to send about our democracy? Stop. You're on your way to vote and exercise your right. People put their lives on the line to defend. Stop. I don't think so. By the way, there's some really basic structural things, in addition to the obstruction, that we've just tolerated because we're just used to it. Can anybody make a principled argument why fellow U.S. citizens living in Washington, D.C., or for that matter, Puerto Rico, have less political representation than we do? Does it make any sense? Can anyone make a principled argument why districts ought to be drawn so the politicians can choose their voters instead of the other way around? I can't think of any. And for my dime, whether you live in a rather blue state or a rather red one, at risk of sounding simplistic, one thing that would be fitting for a democracy when it chooses its national leader is to elect the president by just counting up all the votes and then giving it to whoever earned the most. That way everybody's vote counts the same. I don't know how you put a thumb on the scale, one way or the other, and say that it's fair. So let's just count everybody the same. Some of these incredibly simple things don't seem to get much traction in our current environment, which is precisely why our environment needs to change. I would say we need to change the channel from the show that we've all been watching. And that's my response to this presidency. You notice I didn't talk about it much. It's not because I don't think about it rather often. It's that you don't even get a presidency like this unless something's wrong. This, by the way, is one reason people in my party need to recognize that some smoking gun proof that the president's not a good guy will not change much. A lot of people, at least where I live, voted with their eyes wide open for a guy they didn't much care for in order to send a message that they wanted to burn the house down. Which is also why any suggestion that our party's message ought to be to promise a return to normal overlooks the extent to which normal hasn't been working for a lot of people. Now, what we've got now isn't working either. But that's exactly why we've got to create a new normal. So we're not going to go on that show. We're not going to play that game. We're going to change the channel. And that's what my campaign is about. Let me close just by mentioning a word that has fallen out of fashion, but I think it's as important as ever, and that's hope. Because you don't do this if you don't have some measure of hope. Running for office is an act of hope. In a certain sense, taking the time to watch somebody talk at you who's running for office is an act of hope. And voting is, and volunteering is. You don't do this unless you think there's some way to make the pulleys and levers of our system work better and make people better off. And when you do that, when you get it right, not that anybody's ever had it perfect, but when you get it right, then I think the freedom, the security, and the democracy we live with will be greatly enhanced so that we will, in fact, by 2054, when I'm entering my retirement and celebrating the fact that I've reached the current age of the current president, that I'll be able to look back at 2020 and say, this is when things really started moving onto a good path for our country. And that's how you will know that we succeeded, not just in an election, but in defining an era. And that's why I'm doing this. So thanks for coming. And we'll do some questions.
Thank you very much, Mayor Pete. Thank you very much for that.
And we have a number of questions here. We'll try to answer as many as they can, as we can, rather. The first one is from a former colleague of mine who's actually Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame. And he wants to know, his name is Perry Arnold, what are the three most important problems our country must address going forward?
Glad you didn't want to know about the trash pickup. We had to move it to where from the back of your house to the front of your house. There's a whole thing. So let me pick up on some of the themes that I just mentioned. I'll try to do it at not too much length so that we can continue getting questions. But I spoke of climate, so let me say just a little more about what I mean when I say that climate security is an imperative. I already described the problem. Let's talk about the solution a bit. First of all, I do think we need to talk about adapting now. Mayors need guidance on what to do if the floodplain isn't where it was supposed to be and won't be again. We also got to act on the front end to stop it from getting worse. I believe the basic contours of what to do are well known. We need a carbon price and dividend, or carbon tax and dividend, if you will. Let's call it what it is and be honest about it. Good news is, if you rebate it back out to the American people, most of us will be made better than whole if we structure it the right way. But it'll help change our economy to move in a direction that is less carbon intensive. I think we've got to have massive investment in R&D, not just on renewable energy, but on energy storage and on carbon storage, taking carbon out of the atmosphere, because it's easier to get to net zero than it is to get to absolute zero, and we've got to do whatever we can. The bigger issue, I think, is that, and this will go to the second thing that I think is a big issue, we obviously have a bit of a crisis of unity in this country, no sense of common purpose. I would also argue that we need something of a national project, that America does better when it is compelled to work on something hard. Sputnik provoked a national project, for example. So did World War II. And in climate, in the problem that climate represents, we also have the makings of something that could be a solution, not just to climate, but to that deeper kind of social or even moral illness that we have as a country. For once, we have the possibility of a national project that isn't just fighting other human beings. And by the way, if we were making good on dealing with climate as a national mobilization that took in the efforts of everything from AmeriCorps volunteers to the defense establishment to the scientific community, we might also be leading the world at a moment when we're struggling to lead the world. Imagine, for example, the terms of this U.S.-China tug-of-war that's going on. If one of the cornerstones of global security was climate diplomacy, and a nation was prestigious in as much as it was part of the solution on climate, that'd be a way to challenge China to catch up, but only if we had our own house in order. So, climate, national unity, picking a third is pretty tough because there's so many, but let me return to democracy and just say that we had a pretty good start in H.R. 1, you know, a pro-democracy, anti-corruption bill that was passed in the House only to die in the Senate. It's the sort of down payment on deeper democratic reforms that I would want to enact the moment I got to the Oval Office.
Okay. Now we'll give you some real easy ones. This is from Joanna Camwell, I think. Joanna, where are you? Are you here? Right over there. Okay, thank you, Joanna. A couple questions came in with the same name. The writing looks awfully similar. Okay. How are you, a man, going to be a strong advocate for women as opposed to an actual woman running for office and being president?
It's a good question, and it's fair game. I think a lot of us are disappointed that we don't have a woman in office right now after 2016. I obviously am not a woman. My old employer, back when I was here at McKinsey, did a study on gender equality in corporate leadership. They looked at boards, they looked at leadership teams, and one of the things they found is that companies that were more gender inclusive in their leadership weren't just better places to work, they're actually more profitable because they made better decisions. And it's just one example of why gender inclusion and gender equality and gender diversity is not just the right thing to do in a moral sense, but it also is the right thing to do in a strategic sense. If that's true for companies, then it must also be true for countries. It's certainly true for cities. Women have had the bulk of the leadership roles in my office, and we have women in so many key roles in our cabinet and in our leadership, and I think it helps us make better decisions. From a policy perspective, there are all kinds of things we need to do, from enacting pay transparency when it comes to how large employers are. You know, if they just have to publish the gender pay gap, I feel like a lot of some of those issues will take care of themselves once they just have to defend what they're doing. But also much more profound issues like the extent to which in our current healthcare reality, being a woman amounts to a pre-existing condition. And I've already shared my views on reproductive freedom. So there's the policy piece, but there's also the cultural element, right? Just is this or is this not a country in which everyone is equal and in which a little over than 50% of our country are represented? So I am who I am. But what I will say is that I believe the next president must be the best president ever on women's equality and gender inclusion, especially if the next president is going to turn out to be a man.
So can we take from your comments, Mayor Pete, that you would be very happy to have as your running mate for vice president, you don't have to give us any names, but a woman?
Very happy.
Okay. This is from City Club member Bonnie Allen. Bonnie, where are you? Back there. Okay. She wants to know what your position is on voting rights for people who are incarcerated or coming out of prison.
Thank you. So there is no question that, first of all, we are an over-incarcerated country, and we need to take a number of steps to deal with that, beginning, in my view, with an end to the private prison industry. But also including steps from sentencing reform to making sure as we move toward legalization of marijuana, as I believe we must, that we are also pursuing a retroactive policy of expungements in order to deal with cases of incarceration where the incarceration did more harm than the offense that led to the sentence. I also believe that when people leave incarceration, not only have they finished paying whatever debt was incurred socially, but also everybody has an interest in them succeeding and contributing. And we talk a lot about helping people succeed and contribute as a part of the economy, but not enough about succeeding and contributing as a citizen. And so I believe the moment that somebody returns to their community without bureaucracy, without obstacles, and certainly without being expected to pay, which is happening in some places and amounts to a poll tax, especially when you consider the pattern of racial inequality that is behind so much of what is happening in our criminal justice system. I believe that the moment that you are out, you are a citizen, and that means you are a voter, and we should reestablish your voting rights right away. Questions deserve a full answer, so I should acknowledge that that some in the activist community would like me to go a step further and extend that to those currently incarcerated. I don't feel comfortable taking that step, but I'm continuing to listen to people who have had some pretty compelling things to say about why they view that issue differently than I do, and that dialogue has been beneficial to me.
Okay. By the way, I think that there are two states, Maine and Vermont, that allow people who are incarcerated to vote. Okay, we've got some really good questions here. We'll try to address as many as we can. This is from Joe Kallenbach with the McHenry County Economic Development Commission. Joe, where are you? Okay. He'd like to know what can be done to revitalize economic conditions in rural and suburban communities.
Obviously, this is something I think about a lot. I'll tell you what works back home. First of all, honesty, that we're not ever going to have quite the economic patterns we used to, and recognition that we don't need to. By the way, some of this is about trade. A lot of this is about technology. I was just at not long ago at a business in South Bend makes shot peening medium. It's those little balls they fire at automotive parts at very high pressure in order to temper them. It's one example of a very kind of characteristic small to mid-size industrial employer in our area. They do $6 or $7 million bucks a year in business. They have 6 or 7 full-time employees. So it's about $1 million per employee. There will be fewer people required on a shop floor each passing year. But the jobs that are being created can be good-paying, secure, and stable jobs. We just got to make sure people are equipped for the fact that those jobs will continue to evolve. And they have as much to do with critical thinking and dealing with what happens when there's an exception to the rule, because the quality control part is going to be bigger in an industrial setting than the kind of physical repeatable tasks will be, that we got to equip people for that. In so many suburban or kind of middle density communities like my own have a lot of these manufacturing employers. Rural areas, I think Democratic politicians always go right to broadband because it's the thing we kind of get if we don't live in a rural community and we care about rural people. And don't get me wrong, broadband is definitely something that we need to extend in an equitable way to the American interior. But there's a lot more going on that needs to be addressed in rural America. The biggest thing, the thing that we do have in common in a community like mine that's more industrial, although it's a short jog to the nearest cornfield for me, is this idea that young people grow up getting this message that success means getting out. And nobody has to tell it to you. You just take that on board. And of course, that's what so many people do, especially in rural communities. And that can break the heart and break the energy of a community, of a family. The irony is, technology also means that for many people, there's never been less requirement that you be somewhere in particular in order to do certain kinds of jobs. And so as I reflect on the disparities in real estate pricing in this country, the fact that in Palo Alto you could pay a certain amount in order to have a parking space that would be more than the mortgage on my nice big house on the river in South Bend, that we also have tremendous opportunity to better distribute where many knowledge workers and different kinds of workers are, and for those who are connected to agriculture, an opportunity to enlist the agricultural sector in being part of the solution on climate. Instead of telling them they're part of the problem, invest heavily in, for example, what I think is a really exciting moonshot kind of idea, which is the quest for a net zero emissions farm. Which we can envision through soil management and other practices, what that might look like, even though today, of course, it does not pencil out without a major subsidy. So I see tremendous opportunity for rural America, and we need to make sure that we are doing it with a view toward what the economic needs are going to be and opportunities are going to be in the next 30 years, instead of trying to find some pickled version of what it looked like in the 1950s and expect that to work in 2020.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor Pete. I've got a couple questions here that deal with international affairs, so I'll sort of try to combine them. This is from Simeon Gasparov. Simeon, where are you? Over there. Hi, how are you, Simeon? Okay. Have a seat. Don't get carried away. Simeon's from Bulgaria. We're glad to have you here. He would like to know, Ashvin Ladd, right down here, would like to know, and Dave Lundy, who's sitting over there at that same table, they want to know about your international policy. Simeon's interested in Eastern Europe. Ashvin would like to know what role a country like India would play in your administration to help offset threats from China. And Mr. Dave Lundy wants to know about, and I think you may have answered this already, the Trump administration march to war in Iran. So, just a couple of easy questions.
All right. So we got Eastern Europe, India, and Iran in 90 seconds. All right. Let me offer a few thoughts. I probably can't deliver a comprehensive framework that would take all of those in within the amount of time that we've got. but each of them deserves attention regionally, and then I'll make one remark globally. So first of all, there is the idea of do no harm, but there's also great opportunity, I think, in our relationship with Eastern Europe. Needless to say, the biggest factor complicating our policy and our relationships in Eastern Europe is the interventions from Russia. And having experienced and not enjoyed an intervention from Russia, I think we could perhaps learn a lot from our allies and friends in other East European states who are more accustomed to this than we are. This does not have to mean that we are escalating tensions or hostility, although I think it does have to mean we have credible responses, whether it's through diplomatic, economic, or security tools. But we also have to make sure we're not dismantling the framework that we really depend on. It might have to change, but it doesn't mean we take it apart. And a good example is the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Russia has not been complying with this treaty for a long time. So the White House just threw it out and said, we're getting out too. I don't think that's the right response, because it supposes that nothing is better than something flawed. What we really needed to do was design a new one that was better, with the right kind of verification and compliance mechanisms, much as I think we are now trading nothing for something in Iran and seeing the consequences of that. Think, when it comes to Iran, about, first of all, how much we have undermined any hope of moderation. If you're an Iranian moderate politician and you sold people on the idea that it was going to pay off to work with the U.S., how much egg on your face do you have now on the question of whether Americans can be trusted? And even if we are questioning whether the Iranian regime can be trusted, with very good reason, that is exactly why we set up a treaty with really rigorous enforcement mechanisms. And we see now the consequences of a chain reaction set off by our unilateral withdrawal. I would also say personnel is policy. And it seems that a lot of this energy for conflict is coming from the National Security Advisor. And I remain mystified that anyone who had that big of a hand in propelling us into the Iraq war is allowed anywhere near the Situation Room at a time like this. I guess we're in trouble.
I just got a call from Wolf Blitzer. He's waiting to talk to you.
I'm very fond of India. They're a very important ally, and we're glad we have a democratic country of that size in it.
Mayor Pete, by the way, I want to let you know you are the third candidate for president who has spoken to the City Club. The current president, before he was nominated in 2016, and, you know, he managed to eke out a victory. We had the mayor of New York, who just declared today, speak, but he was not a candidate. And we wish you the absolute best in your campaign.